In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Usable news and information for your job. And now, here's Francis Rose.
Welcome to the program for Wednesday, October 5th, 2011 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Wednesday in the 3 o'clock hour is Pentagon Solutions, when we have a deep dive conversation where we talk to experts on defense issues, both experts inside DOD and outside DOD, and we talk about ideas that leaders in the Pentagon and the contracting community can use to solve the big challenges that the defense community faces. And today, talking to two folks from the Government Accountability Office about work they've done on DOD issues. Later on in the hour, I'll introduce you to Belva Martin. She's the Director of Acquisition and Sourcing Management Issues at GAO, and we're going to talk about the defense acquisition workforce. We lead off, though, with John Hutton, also a Director of Acquisition and Sourcing Management Issues at GAO. This report on contingency contracting is what we're going to focus on in the first part of the program. And, John, it's good to talk to you. Thanks for coming on the program today.
Well, thank you for asking.
Happy to do it. The report is called Improved Planning and Management Oversight Needed to Address Challenges with Closing Contracts. We've focused on this program and on this radio station a lot on the work of the Commission on Wartime Contracting in Iraq and Afghanistan, but you're looking at one particular element here of the issues that are ongoing, especially in Iraq. Talk about what exactly you looked at and where you started to do this study.
Sure. A lot of the work that we've done in the past, as well as others, tended to look at the front end of the process, the planning for and the awarding of contracts, and then, of course, the oversight and contract management related issues. But for this particular effort, we wanted to take a look at the back end of the process, the administrative tasks that are required to close out a contract.
You write in this report, contract closeout's a key step to ensure the government receives the goods and services it purchased at the agreed upon price, and if done in a timely manner, provides opportunities to use unspent funds for other needs. That seems like a pretty logical statement up front. Obviously, there was some issue that somebody in Congress found that caused them to want to get you on this topic in the first place.
Well, work that we've done and others, you know, talked about the shortcomings in DOD's strategic planning for the overall operational contract support and some of the contract administration oversight issues. And also there's been a number of reports that talked about the acquisition workforce and the contingency operations. So all these elements coming together, I think, as we found, also played into our findings as related to the closing out of the contracts. DOD has spent obligated over $160 billion for goods and services to support the efforts in Iraq and Afghanistan. And much of this work is done. So now closing a contract is the final step in the process.
All right. This report says that you looked at four main elements of the issue of closing contracts. I want to review them and have you walk me through each one of them, if
okay.
We could. The first one is the number of contracts that are eligible for closeout and the extent to which they'll be closed within required time frames. Talk about that for a moment.
Right. That particular objective of ours was one of the more difficult ones because, as we found, DOD really didn't have good visibility into the number of contracts that they had that were eligible for closeout. And so we spent, quite a bit of time trying to gather a lot of data to get a good handle on how many contracts have been completed, to what extent have they been closed, and it was kind of a piecemeal process for us to pull all that data together. But yet, even then, we didn't have a solid number that we could put out there in the report.
Is there a difference between, or a big difference between, the number of contracts period and the number of contracts that are eligible for closure? I mean, if I look at it from the outside, I would think, well, this is a situation in Iraq where eventually we'll want to move out, and theoretically all contracts would be eligible for closure at some point.
Right. It was hard for us to put a number on a percent of how many contracts that are eligible to be closed have been closed versus have not been, but through various pieces of data, we found that for the most part, most contracts that were eligible were not closed.
All right. The second one of these elements, factors contributing to contracts not being closed within required time frames, was this a little bit easier than the first one because you were working on this one only from the ones that you were actually able to get a handle on?
Well, as part of the work, we identified three things that we felt hindered the overall efforts to close the contract. And one was the planning, upfront planning. We found that the DoD contingency contracting doctrine and policies really didn't specifically include the closeout as part of their advanced planning for an operation. So we also found that the organizations we visited generally did not conduct any planning for contract closeouts until several years after the contractors were initially awarded. And there's a variety of reasons for that.
Can you tell me some of those reasons?
Sure. In some ways, I think there was, in part, you could say workforce is a factor. You know, that having the people in place when they're awarding the contracts, but also having sufficient people to oversee and then administer the contract, what we found that because of the urgent need to support the warfighter, and I don't think anyone would have doubt for that, in awarding contracts, that tended to get the priorities over the back end, the closing out of the contract. So that's just an example where, you know, the limited workforce kind of contributed to that.
All right. The third factor, that, or the third element that you looked at, was the steps DoD took to manage the financial risks associated with not closing contracts within required timeframes. What is that all about?
Well, let me first mention what we're talking about for some of these risks. One of them is that if funds aren't deobligated, as you're closing out a contract, there's some remaining funds on that contract. If you don't deobligate it, you know, the funds really won't be available, perhaps for other uses within the agency. If you don't close out on time, the funds get canceled, and you may be in a position later when you do close out the contract that you have some anticipated costs that you have to go back and pay the contractor. So that money has to come from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And also probably important is you have increased risk of late payments, which may result in government paying interest. So, you know, these are key risks that I think are important when you think about the need to close the contracts. And what we found in some cases that there, we did find examples that there were interest payments made associated with late payments of contracts, things of that nature.
The fourth element is the extent to which DoD captured and implemented lessons learned from closing its Iraq contracts.
Mm-hmm.
And that just seems to me to go to the whole best practices thing that not just DoD, but a lot of agencies struggle with, is how do you, first of all, understand what you did either well or not so well, and then how do you put that into practice, either doing it again if it was done well or not doing it anymore if it wasn't.
Right. And I think in the case of Afghanistan, we saw and had discussions with the DoD officials where, you know, they are taking actions to address some of these things that we talk about in this particular report. One of the things that we found early on when we went into Iraq is we didn't really have a contract management system that would allow us to help ensure we have good data from the beginning. A lot of this stuff was done manually up front, and that was one of the reasons why it was hard to pull all this information together. So they're looking to develop deployable contract management systems for any future contingency operation. And also, I think they're looking to more explicitly include requirements for ensuring that contract closeout is incorporated into your contracting planning documents.
All right. You touched briefly on what you found, but I'd like to dig into what you found a little bit more when we come back from the break.
Great.
John Hutton's my guest at the Government Accountability Office on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. The report on contingency contracting is what we're talking about. You can find that report linked up at federalnewsradio.com on the In Depth page, and we'll continue our conversation in just a moment.
Things to know about the proposed merger of AT&T and T-Mobile. With the planned merger, AT&T will invest $8 billion more and deploy the next generation of wireless internet to nearly everyone in America. This investment will create as many as 96,000 American jobs. We're not investing to create jobs, but jobs will be created because we're investing. AT&T.
CSC will host a special open house hiring event in support of their National Security Agency contracts for their Hanover, Maryland openings on Friday, October 14th from 3 to 7 p.m. and Saturday, October 15th from 8 a.m. to noon at CSC, 7231 Parkway Drive, Hanover. CSC, named in Fortune Magazine's Most Admired Companies, is seeking to fill a variety of positions. For more information, visit csc.com/careers and click on the Careers Events tab, an equal opportunity employer.
The Government IT Solutions Spotlight is brought to you by CDWG.
The White House turns to interns to improve their software development process. White House Chief Information Officer Brooke Colangelo says on a blog on CIO.gov that four computer science students created the Software Automation and Technology, or SWAT, team to help improve agency business systems more quickly. The group used an agile development approach to work on 40 different projects over the summer. Colangelo says the SWAT team revolutionized their business process support and software development services.
If you're in federal IT, you know that every internet connection and every mobile device poses a threat to your data. Visit cdwg.com/security to learn how our security experts use the latest technology to help keep your agency ahead of those threats. CDWG, people who get it.
Visit cdwg.com to learn how scalable security solutions from McAfee can defend your agency's network with less to deploy and manage.
Do you know us? We employ more than 70,000 people in more than 800 locations throughout the United States. Through our network of suppliers, we indirectly enable tens of thousands of American jobs. Tens of thousands. Jobs that put food on the table. Jobs that put kids through college. Jobs that keep our economy going. And yet, many of you don't even know who we are. Our name is United Technologies. We are Carrier, Hamilton Sunstrand, Otis, Pratt & Whitney, Sikorsky, and UTC Fire and Security. Six businesses united as one powerful company. We may be the biggest unknown company in America, but our jobs power the economy, and our technologies, products, and services power the world. United Technologies. Get to know more about us at UTC.com.
Tom Temin here with a preview of tomorrow's Federal Drive. The intelligence community's research arm is launching a program to have computers read the world's scientific literature in dozens of languages. It hopes to ferret out the next important technology. And transportation went ahead without Congress and paid furloughed FAA workers their back pay. We'll find out if it was legal. Those stories and more tomorrow morning starting at 6 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. It's Pentagon Solutions in the 3 o'clock hour on Wednesday, where we look at the challenges the Pentagon's dealing with and talk about ideas to solve those challenges. My guest in the first part of the program is John Hutton, a director of acquisition and sourcing management issues at the Government Accountability Office, talking about contingency contracting. And later on in the hour, his colleague Belva Martin will be my guest. As she will talk about a report on the defense acquisition workforce, one of the major challenges that DOD's been dealing with for a long time. But, John, continuing our conversation about your report on contingency contracting, you talked in the first segment about taking a look at closing out contracts, especially in Iraq. What did you find as you dug into the way that the Department of Defense is trying to close out contracts in Iraq, the problems that they're having doing so, and maybe even the problems they're having identifying which ones need to be closed out and how they're going about that process?
Sure. One of the key steps I think DOD took to try to get a handle on this issue was because they had a lot of contract documents in Iraq, they sent a lot of those documents back to the states here and established a task force. And those folks would specifically spend their time reviewing all the documentation and trying to close out those contracts. And as a report noted, there were, I think, almost up to 100,000 contracts that had to be reviewed and closed out. They're still going through that process, but I think that was a key step that they took. The other thing was they delegated some of their contract administration including some closeout responsibilities to a sister DoD organization, the Defense Contract Management Agency, which I think helped them improve their visibility of the large cost-type contracts, which are much more involved in trying to close those out.
That actually goes to one of the things I wanted to ask you about. You write in this report, the U.S. Central Command's Contracting Command, C3, and its predecessors, which awarded many of DoD's Iraq contracts, didn't have sufficient internal controls to ensure that contracting data were accurate and complete. Was that transition process itself part of the problem, or was it just the way that the documentation was conducted by whoever it was that was responsible for it at the time?
Right. I think the key thing there, what we're referring to, is that when we went in early on, we didn't go in with any kind of standard procurement system that pretty much or contract writing system. You pretty much used a lot of manual databases. They've put in a standard procurement system now over there, and that's going to help with a lot of data entry. It's going to help with some of the reporting and things of that nature. So that probably was a key step from what we found in this particular work.
You also note in this report something that other reports about operations in Iraq, not peculiar to contracting necessarily, but just operations overall, and that is, you write, DoD's ability to close its contracts has been hindered by the lack of advanced planning, workforce shortfalls, and contractor accounting challenges. What did you not find, or what did you find lacking when it came to the advanced planning piece of that?
Well, again, I think what we found was that not planning for it sufficiently in advance meant that you didn't either have the sufficient workforce to help you do it, because I think that was key in doing the contract closeouts. If you wait too long over time, you know, you might have issues of not having all the documentation that you need, particularly in an environment like Iraq. So, again, while we noted three factors, that planning being one of them, that really contributed to the efforts to close out contracts, I think workforce was a significant one. Another one is that a lot of these contracts, or a number of them, were cost-type contracts, which requires audits to help close out the contract. You have to have the Defense Contract Audit Agency support the closing of that by looking at, the contractor's records and making sure everything's done before you do that. And that was another thing, that a challenge we found, was that the some accounting issues as it related to that activity.
In the first segment, you talked about the fact that if the contracts are not closed out right, money's not available anymore. And then when we finally get around to closing the contracts, if further payments are required, the money's no longer available. Where's that money go?
If the contracts are closed within the proper times and the money's deobligated, that money can stay within the activity and perhaps be applied to some other type of urgent need or expenditure. If they fail to close a contract and say that money expires, money has a certain life of its own. If that money expires, then it's just basically essentially like returned to the Treasury.
And so that's why that money becomes no longer available, because it's technically not in a DoD account anymore.
Yeah, we had a figure in our report, I believe, that DoD estimated that at least $135 million in contract funding could return to Treasury by the end of this most recent fiscal year, if it wasn't deobligated. But that wasn't a complete number. There could be other funds not yet identified.
You also wrote, instances of improper payments and potential fraud were sometimes found years after final contract deliveries were made, making it harder for DoD to recover funds and increasing the risk that it may need to pay contractors interest fees on late payments. Is that another issue just that kind of ties into the cost-type contracts and the auditing that's required there, or is that a separate thing?
Well, that's part of it, but I think it gets back to the main theme, though. The more timely you can close out contracts, you can avoid some of these things. I think DoD has taken some steps to help in this particular area because one of their defense finance agencies became responsible for making payments, I think it was back in 2008, for contracts awarded in Iraq. And that, I think that helped the process of improving their payment process.
You write, the growing backlog of over 42,000 Afghanistan contracts that need to be closed suggests the underlying causes have not been resolved. So it's kind of one of these, there's some progress, but not moving maybe quite fast enough. Is that fair to say?
Well, yes, they're in a similar situation, although I don't have the hard figures, but the scale of that, the contracts won't be as much as you might see in Iraq, particularly at this point in time. But DOD, you know, has reported taking some actions. One thing that they did was they increased the number of their contracting officers in Afghanistan from a period of 2008 to now, and it went from like 60 contracting officers to about 200. So as I mentioned earlier, one of the causes was the having sufficient acquisition workforce. So that's a good thing, and I think that's going to help them perhaps, you know, stay up as best they can with the ones they're awarding now and maybe helping to close out some of the contracts. But, you know, there's still some that they're going to have to close, and some of them are going to be older.
Walk me through the recommendations that you made in this, please.
Sure. We had several recommendations. One was to recommend that the Secretary of the Army help ensure that there's sufficient resources to help with the closeout demands. As I mentioned earlier, they set up a task force, and there's a contracting activity that's helping to close out all these, and I think it's just a matter of, you know, having them recommend that they go in and make sure they have a better match of the people that they can use to help close out these contracts. That was one of them. Another one, though, we had a recommendation to the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And there were two actions there. One, we wanted to make sure they revise their contingency contracting doctrine and guidance to better reflect the need for advanced planning for contract closeout. And the second was we thought it was important that senior contracting officials monitor and assess the progress of the closeout activities over the course of the contingency so that steps can be taken if backlogs continue.
I appreciate you being with me to explain this report. John, we have it linked up at federalnewsradio.com on the in-depth page, and I appreciate your time today.
Well, thank you very much.
John Hutton's the Director of Acquisition and Sourcing Management Issues at the Government Accountability Office, and that report on contingency contracting, as I mentioned, linked up on the in-depth page. When we continue on Pentagon Solutions, John Hutton's colleague at the Government Accountability Office, Belva Martin, will be here to talk about defense acquisition workforce issues. Next on Pentagon Solutions, this is In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Did you leave it? Where could it have possibly gone? It's frustrating because you used to have your motivation with you all the time, and now, ugh. That's okay. We'll help you find it. First, let's find your reason. You know, your reason. What's that thing that makes you want to live to an age where you can say whatever you want to whomever you want, and somehow it becomes charming? Next, find your thing. What is that healthy thing you actually love doing? There's got to be one, right? Finally, go find your partner. Who's the ping to your pong? The downward to your dog? Who'll keep your butt moving and vice versa? Find all of those things. We're pretty sure your motivation will magically appear. But if you're still having trouble finding it, try looking really, really hard in the mirror. We're Kaiser Permanente, and we're here to help you find your motivation to thrive. Visit kp.org/thrive.
Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Mid-Atlantic States Incorporated, 2101 East Jefferson Street, Rockville, Maryland, 20852.
Here are the ins and outs of Hyundai from the people who know it inside and out, the people who actually work here.
They allow you to grow with the company. That is Hyundai. That's the difference.
It's all about jobs. I love my job.
I am happy to be here. I'm proud to be here.
We're all like one big family.
Pride of ownership and pride of craftsmanship.
I feel a sense of pride. I feel a sense of accomplishment. Something that we all can rejoice in because we've done this together.
Building cars that Americans want.
Teamwork, commitment, and pride.
I love working with my team. We're more of a family.
It's about building cars in America.
Yeah, it's a good feeling. It really is.
What they used to call the American way.
It still works here.
This is not just a job. This is a career. We have a career here.
Proud partner in the American dream. Dream with us at HyundaiAmerica.us.
I'm so proud that my kids are proud. They're proud of me. So we love Hyundai.
Hyundai. New thinking. New possibilities.
Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series, Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government, Friday at 10 a.m., right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
Billions on obesity. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Nicholas Garlow with HHS HealthBeat. How much does America's weight problem cost in dollars and cents? Researchers have figured out the price just in medical care for conditions that could be blamed on obesity, such as diabetes, heart disease, and high blood pressure. The researchers, who included experts at HHS's Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, compared the cost of treating obese people with those for healthy weight people. At the RTI International Research Firm in North Carolina, Justin Trogdon.
Nationally, obesity is about 9% of all medical expenditures and could be as much as $147 billion annually.
Costs were higher in states with more people and similarly higher in states with a greater proportion of obese people. The study was in the journal Obesity. Learn more at hhs.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Nicholas Garlow.
Efforts are ramping up as agencies will close nearly 200 data centers by the end of the year to meet the target of consolidating at least 800 of the government's 2,000 centers. In March, the Data Center Consolidation Task Force will publish government-wide best practices to include management of private, public, and traditional data centers. Join FCO Bethesda October 14th at the Bethesda North Marriott for an early report on the future of data center consolidation. Register today at fcobethesda.org/octbreakfast.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, continuing Pentagon Solutions today, as we do every Wednesday in the 3 o'clock hour. Pentagon Solutions is a series where we talk to people who are focusing on defense issues, people both inside and outside of DOD, and hearing ideas about improving situations in the Pentagon, challenges that the Department of Defense is dealing with. And we continue our GAO focus on the program today with Belva Martin, a director of acquisition and sourcing management issues at GAO. She has led the team that worked on a report called Defense Acquisition Workforce, Better Identification, Development, and Oversight Needed for Personnel Involved in Acquiring Services. Belva, it's great to have you on the program. Thanks for joining me today.
And thank you for having me.
Happy to do it. Services is something that DOD and all federal agencies, to be fair, have struggled with. Buying the best or cheapest widget is pretty easy. Services is a whole different thing. Talk about what you were charged to look at in this study, why you did it in the first place.
Well, this was actually a follow-on to some work that we issued last year where we looked at the acquisition workforce, and that's mainly dealing with acquiring weapon systems. But as you rightfully mentioned, acquiring services is different because it's much more varied in terms of anything from landscaping to professional services, et cetera. So that was in part why we were looking at how DOD identifies as well as provides oversight over the personnel involved in service acquisition.
One of the acronyms that we'll hear throughout our conversation, I imagine, is DAWIA, the Defense Acquisition Workforce Improvement Act. And I have to say I'm disappointed in whatever member of Congress drafted that, because usually these acronyms can turn into a nice tidy word, and DAWIA is not really very, it doesn't roll off the tongue exactly. But at any rate, this report, you're looking at personnel who are working on services acquisitions outside of that acquisition workforce. Who exactly are we talking about here?
We are talking about varied individuals. They can be technical experts that are involved on a one-time basis with a contract. They can actually be a contract officer representatives. They can be legal professionals, and part of, which we'll get to in a minute, the difficulty that DOD has is that these personnel are somewhat transient, they are scattered, and they don't do this on a full-time basis.
The idea that some folks are covered by this Improvement Act and some folks aren't, I think, might be a little puzzling to people. As you reviewed the legislation, did you get a sense of why some folks are covered under this and why some folks aren't?
Well, the legislation that we termed WEA was passed actually in 1990, so it's been quite a while, and it was to address issues related to the acquisition workforce and to create certification requirements. And DOD defined the acquisition workforce to cover mainly the professionals that are involved in acquisition of weapons. So that in part is why some folks are outside of that workforce.
And that fits then with the whole services issue, because the procurement chain and the methodology is dramatically different.
Yes.
All right. You wrote here you reviewed a non-generalized sample of 29 service contracts, relevant policies and recommendations from previous reports, met with key DOD officials. How did you choose those 29 service contracts? Were they just kind of chosen at random from among the service contracts, or was there a process there?
No, we actually had a process. We were looking at trying to get a mix of the different services. We were looking at contracts that were active and awarded in fiscal year 2009. That was the most complete data, and they were valued at more than $1 million each. We did not include weapons systems acquisition because we also did not include contracts in the contingency environment, meaning Iraq, Afghanistan, et cetera. So we did have criteria that we used to select these contracts.
All right. I'd like to talk about what you found when we come back from the break. My guest is Belva Martin. She's a director of acquisition and sourcing management issues at the Government Accountability Office. And the report that we're talking about is linked up right now at federalnewsradio.com on the in-depth page. We'll continue our conversation when we come back.
Government technology professionals should prepare to attend GovCom 2011, the new trade show featuring government audiovisual communication solutions at the Walter E. Washington Convention Center, November 1st and 2nd, featuring nearly 100 leading manufacturers and solutions providers showcasing the latest in audio-video, conferencing, collaboration, control systems, digital signage, and visual display technologies. GovCom will help government agencies and the military boost collaboration, enhance security, improve reliability, and cut costs. GovCom is your opportunity to see cutting-edge communications products, network with fellow technology professionals, and get valuable training from leading experts in government and industry. For more information and your free exhibits pass, visit GovCom with two M's, show.org, and use the code FED. That's govcomshow.org. GovCom is brought to you by Infocom International, the association representing the audiovisual industry.
We live in uncertain times. More than ever, federal agencies rely on TASC to accomplish the most important missions and protect America's way of life. Few in the world can do what the experts at TASC do. Trusted partners, honest counselors, TASC's highly specialized problem solvers use rare knowledge and deep experience to provide advanced systems engineering, integration, and decision support services that the U.S. government depends on to keep the country safe and secure. TASC, working for you and the nation. TASC.com.
Newsmakers, talk to Jason Miller.
David Hinson is the director of the Minority Business Development Agency.
The White House is going to set up a new businessusa.gov site. There are many departments. The government does a lot to provide a lot of services to a lot of different people with very specific needs. There's still more work that needs to be done to help people understand the broad range of services and support that the government provides, particularly to minority-owned businesses and small businesses.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/federaldrive.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's Pentagon Solutions, where we look into solutions for some of the challenges that the Pentagon's dealing with. One of those challenges is the Defense Acquisition Workforce. And the Government Accountability Office is just one of the organizations that has looked at defense acquisition and the workforce issues surrounding it in DOD. And Belva Martin of GAO is my guest to talk about her most recent report on the acquisition workforce at DOD. Belva, we talked in the first segment about what exactly you were looking at and who you were looking at, the workforce that was not covered by. Tell me how you pronounce the acronym again.
DAWEA.
Okay, I'm going to write it down so I continue to get it. As you looked at those non-DAWEA personnel, what did you see in how they were doing what they were doing?
Well, what we did was we, for those 29 contracts, we asked DOD to identify the personnel involved, and they identified 430 personnel, and we found that a little over half, 218 or 51%, were outside of DAWEA, so they were non-DAWEA personnel. We also know from our past work that folks that are involved with DAWEA are tracked. And they have training and other certification requirements. The Defense Acquisition University was created in part to provide training, et cetera, to these individuals covered by DAWEA. But the non-DAWEA personnel, again, are not covered and they are not tracked. So one of the things we wanted to find out is what kind of training is provided. And so we did have some information about that.
Did you get a sense of why they were not being tracked, or was it just kind of an afterthought because since they weren't covered under the DAWEA, they just kind of got lost track of?
I think a part of it is that DOD was focused on the weapon systems acquisition, and while they recognize the importance of service acquisitions, they have not gotten around to looking at this population. But DOD officials were very receptive to the work that we were doing, as well as our recommendations.
As they try to identify these people and kind of include them in what they're doing, is it the case that whatever training they're providing for the DAWEA personnel would also work for the folks non-DAWEA, or is it the fact that since DAWEA folks are mostly working on weapon systems and we're talking about services procurements that the training wouldn't cross?
Some of the training might, but again, as a part of that identification, one of the things that we're recommending that DOD undertake is to identify the critical skills that these personnel who are outside of DAWEA need. So some of the courses that the Defense Acquisition University has already developed may be appropriate, and we actually found that some of the non-DAWEA folks are actually taking some of those courses.
Did you get a sense, though, that the training that they were getting was appropriate for the jobs that they were performing?
That was not something that we looked at, and the Defense Acquisition University does not track that, again, because their focus is on the acquisition professionals that are covered by DAWEA.
Gotcha. What kind of training were the non-DAWEA folks taking?
The training varied. Again, it was some of the same types of training that the DAWEA personnel were taking. There were courses such as fundamentals of systems acquisition management. There was training for the contract officer representatives, performance-based service acquisition, ethics. So the training varied.
As you dug into that training and talked to the people who were appropriate here, and then talked about that with DOD, what was their response to this training piece of this?
They recognize that there is a gap because they are, again, the officials at the Defense Acquisition University are trying to keep up with the demand for training for the DAWEA personnel. They are aware that some non-DAWEA personnel or professionals are taking the training, but again, their focus, at least right now, is on the DWEA personnel.
Mm-hmm.
So, but again, they are aware of the fact that there is a demand there, and they have developed some online courses to try to meet that demand. And again, as a part of their identification of not only the personnel but the skills that they need, we would imagine they would tailor the training to these personnel. Some of it may be just-in-time training. Some of it may be on-the-job training. So it is not necessarily just classroom or type training.
You mentioned some elements here, Belva, that I think kind of underscore all the moving parts that are involved here. You write the House Armed Services Committee and the Defense Science Board issued reports since 2009 that made recommendations that were relevant to this population but made too recently for you at GAO to assess their implementation. And you mentioned the House Armed Services Committee Panel on Defense Acquisition Reform report recommended DOD reform the services requirements process in order to address the different set of challenges services acquisitions pose compared to the procurement of goods. And I did take a look at the Defense Acquisition Reform Panel's report, and when you open that up, then that goes to a whole nother list of issues that are there that aren't necessarily even connected to the acquisition workforce. So it's easy to see how trying to piece all of these puzzle pieces together can get complicated. Does any of the work either in this report or that you've done in the past focus on that and on how to connect all of these different parts and try to pull them together?
Well, as you said, there has been more focus recently on service acquisitions, in part because of the amount of money that DOD and the government spends on services and the fact that there have been some difficulties. So these other reports are looking at it in a little bit more holistic fashion and not focused just on the training, but obviously the training is a key piece. And as I mentioned earlier, part of the difficulty for DOD in terms of the work that we did is, unlike the DWEA folks who are career professionals, they do this kind of on a full-time basis when you think of contracting officers and business professionals. The non-DWEA folks, as I mentioned, may just be a technical expert to advise on a particular contract or part of a source selection. They may do it early in their career, may come back and do it later on. So it is a transient population that makes the identification a little bit challenging for DOD.
That's one of the major recommendations, though, and I want to talk about that when we come back from the break, if we can. My guest is Belva Martin. She is a director of acquisition and sourcing management issues at the Government Accountability Office on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. It's Pentagon Solutions on In Depth with Francis Rose. We'll be right back.
This week's Experts in Health topic is prostate health, featuring Dr. Antonio Michel, urologist with the Mid-Atlantic Permanente Medical Group at the Kaiser Permanente Falls Church Medical Center.
Prostate cancer is the most common cancer in men. While the causes of prostate cancer are unknown, risk factors such as age, race, ethnicity, and family history may increase a man's chance of getting prostate cancer. Prostate cancer is most commonly found in men age 65 or older and occurs in African-American men more frequently than men of any other race. Prostate cancer is usually curable when detected early. Regular health checkups, including a digital rectal exam of the prostate and a PSA blood test, are vital to early detection. We at Kaiser Permanente encourage men to be proactive about their health and maintain regular health checkups with their doctor. Be well and thrive.
To learn more about Kaiser Permanente's Experts in Health, visit kp.org/midatlantic and click Meet Our Doctors.
Meeting mission goals through technology, brought to you by General Dynamics Information Technology.
After a long preparation period, the Department of Veterans Affairs is beginning to roll out a new generation of smartphones and tablet devices. VA is taking it slow. They plan to issue about 1,000 new devices, mostly iPhones and iPads, over the coming year. And to make sure the devices don't expose VA to data breaches, they'll be limited to a couple functions for the time being. They'll handle secure, encrypted email and data viewing without the ability to store information on the devices.
General Dynamics Information Technology is dedicated to providing the latest, highest quality information technology services and resources to help organizations meet their mission objectives. Large-scale IT systems and communications networks are the strategic and operational heart of defense, intelligence, civilian government, and private business. They require the expertise of a company that delivers results. General Dynamics Information Technology and professional services. Go to GDIT.com to learn more. That's GDIT.com.
Tradition never graduates. Bring your family and friends to spend the day in Annapolis with Navy football. See the midshipmen take on the Southern Miss Golden Eagles Saturday, October 8th at 3:30 p.m. at Navy Marine Corps Memorial Stadium, presented by Navy Mutual Aid Association. Join us for a game day atmosphere like no other. Buy your tickets today to see Navy versus Southern Mississippi, October 8th at 3:30 p.m. Get the best seats now by calling 1-800-US-4-NAVY or by logging on to NavySports.com.
Join 36,000 people from around the world, including senior leaders from the Army, DOD, and Congress, at the 2011 AUSA Annual Meeting and Exposition. This professional development forum is October 10th through the 12th at the Washington Convention Center and features exhibits on two levels and in five halls, all centered around this year's theme, America's Army, the Strength of the Nation. Admission is free but limited to qualified persons. For more information, please visit www.ausa.org.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, on Pentagon Solutions Today, a focus on the Government Accountability Office and some work that they are doing and publishing regarding issues that the Pentagon is dealing with. My thanks to John Hutton of the GAO for joining me in the first part of the program, and Belva Martin, my thanks to you for being here for the second part of the program to talk about your report on the defense acquisition workforce. I appreciate your time today.
And thank you again for having me.
Happy to do it. What are the recommendations that come out of this look that you've taken at the DOEA personnel? I'm still struggling with that acronym. And the non-DOEA personnel that you looked at in this report?
As we mentioned, these personnel who are not covered under DOEA, that is, they don't have specific training or certification requirements, are very important to service acquisitions. They may be involved in helping to develop the requirements and overseeing the acquisition. So for DOD to be able to identify that the right people with the right skills are involved, it's important for them to do a number of things. And one, we recommended that they establish criteria and a time frame for identifying these folks who are involved outside of DOEA. The second recommendation is that they assess the critical skills, again, to find out what these folks need to be successful, and then make an organization responsible for tracking, because obviously that accountability is very important.
Now, you mentioned this is the non-DOEA folks are a transient population because they're not necessarily engaged in acquisition full time. They're transitioning in and out of that role. Any recommendations specifically about how DOD should try to identify those folks?
We did not make any specific recommendations in that area, again, leaving it to DOD, but the way we were able to identify was through our contract review, looking at various service contracts and the individuals and what role did they play. So that's obviously one opportunity for DOD to do something similar through the services or the components.
When someone sits and goes through the report, and I will confess I didn't go through every word of every page, I apologize for that, but I did consume a fair amount of this. What do you want somebody to take away from this overall as far as where DOD is in developing its acquisition workforce on both sides of the DOEA equation, folks who are covered under that and who are not?
Well, as you said, DOD has done a good job of identifying the personnel, the training requirements, the certification for folks who are involved on the acquisition of weapons side, and they recognize the importance of doing it for the folks who are involved with service contracts. So the task ahead is for the Defense Acquisition University and others to, again, identify these personnel, identify their critical skills, and then develop training as appropriate. And as I mentioned, it may not always be classroom training. It could be other types of training. So that's, I think, the important takeaway is that there is a group of professionals that are very key to service acquisitions, and you want to make sure that they are fully trained and equipped.
I want to hop back to one element of the training quickly before I let you go, Belva. You write, the Air Force required two Air Force-specific phases of training, while the Navy and Marine Corps policy didn't specify what training was required. Is there a need for uniformity among the branches here, or is it just more important that there is some kind of set policy rather than it all has to be the same amongst all the branches?
I think you keyed on it. Set policy is very important because you want to allow some variability depending on the specific needs of the services, but have an overall policy that would be uniformly implemented is the key.
Belva, I appreciate your time this afternoon. Thank you for being here, and we're linking your report up at federalnewsradio.com on the in-depth page. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Francis.
Belva Martin's the Director of Acquisition and Sourcing Management Issues at the Government Accountability Office on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. And you can not only read her report, but also the report from John Hutton, her colleague at GAO, on contingency contracting on the in-depth page at federalnewsradio.com. 3:55 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, coming up on In-Depth at 4:30 in your cybersecurity update, a new initiative to bring down botnets. At 4:40 in your DoD report, some tough words of warning from Army brass. But first, maybe your agency's workforce shouldn't just be your agency's workforce. Some inside information on the new FedCloud idea next on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.